glow from the data coil, I fixed my gaze on the juncture of her thighs with a kind of desperation, and she fed me into herself with the confidence of someone chambering around. The heat and pressure in the long, tensed body riding me with the fragments I used to keep going, but it still wasn't what you'd call great sex. I slipped free a couple of times, and my problems became hers as the obvious lack of abandonment braked her excitement back to not much more than methodical, technical expertise and a determination to get this done. "Do you see how?" I flailed down the voice in the back of my head and brought some determination of my own to match that of the woman I was joined to. For a while it was work, attention to posture and tight smiles. Then I pushed a thumb into her mouth, let her moisten it, and used it to find her clitoris in the crux of her spread legs. She took my other hand and pressed it onto her breast, and not long after she found an orgasm of sorts. I didn't, but in the grinning, sweat-soaked kiss we shared after she had come, that didn't seem to matter so much. It wasn't great sex, but it slammed the door on Cemetery for a while, and later, when Cruikshank pulled her clothes back together and went back up on deck, to cheers and applause from the rest of the party, I stayed in the gloom waiting for him, and he still chose not to show. It was the closest thing to a victory that I ever enjoyed on Sanction 4. Chapter 26. Consciousness hit me in the head like a freak fighter's claw. I flinched from the impact and rolled over in the bedshelf, trying to crawl back into sleep, but the movement brought with it a rolling wave of nausea. I stopped the vomit in its tracks with an effort of will and propped myself up on one elbow, blinking. Daylight was boring a blurry hole through the gloom above my head from a porthole I hadn't noticed the night before. At the other end of the cabin, the data coil wove its tireless spiral from the emanator on the desk to the shelved systems data in the top left-hand corner. Voices came through the bulkhead behind me. Check functionality. I heard Virginia Vidara's admonitions from the Envoy training modules. It's not injury you're concerned with, it's damage. Pain you can either use or shut down. Wounds matter only if they cause structural impairment. Don't worry about the blood, it isn't yours. You put this flesh on a couple of days ago and you'll be taking it off again soon if you can manage not to get killed first. Don't worry about wounds, check your functionality. My head felt as if someone were sawing it in half from the inside. Waves of feverish sweat spread down through me, apparently from a point on the back of my scalp. The floor of my stomach had climbed and was nestling somewhere at the base of my throat. My lungs hurt in an obscure, misted way. It felt as if I'd been shot with a stunner in my jacket pocket, on a not particularly low beam. Functionality. Thanks, Virginia. Hard to tell how much of this was hangover and how much was dying. Hard to care. I worked myself cautiously into a sitting position on the edge of the shelf and noticed for the first time that I'd fallen asleep more or less in my clothes. I searched my pockets, turned up the battlefield medic's gun and the anti-radiation capsules. I weighed the transparent plastic tubes in one hand and thought about it. The shock of injection was very likely going to make me vomit. A deeper trawl through my pockets finally turned up a stick of military-issue painkillers. I snapped one loose, held it between finger and thumb, and looked at it for a moment, then added a second. Conditioned reflex took the controls as I checked the delivery muzzle of the medic's gun, cleared the breech, and loaded the two crystal-filled capsules nose to tail. I snapped the slide, and the gun made a high-pitched scaling whine as the magnetic field charged. My head twinged, an excruciatingly hard under soft sensation that made me, for some reason, think of the flex of systems data floating in the corner of the coil at the other end of the room. The charged light winked redly at me from the gun. Inside the breech, inside the capsules, the military format crystal shards would be aligned, sharp-edged ends pointing down the barrel like a million poised daggers. I pushed the muzzle against the crook of my elbow and squeezed the trigger. The relief was instant. A soft red rush through my head, wiping the pain away in smudges of pink and gray. Wedge issue, nothing but the very best for Carrera's wolves. I smirked to myself, stoned on the endorphin boost, and groped for the anti-radiation capsules. Feeling pretty fucking functional now, Virginia. Dumped out the shredded painkiller caps, reloaded with anti-rad, snapped the slide. Look at yourself, Kovach. A dying, disintegrating set of cells, woven back together with chemical thread. That didn't sound like Virginia Vidora, so it might have been Cemetery, creeping back from last night's retreat. I pushed the observation to the back of my mind and focused on function. You put this flesh on a couple of days ago, and you'll be taking it off again soon. Yeah, yeah. Waiting out the rising wine. Waited for the red-eyed wink. Shot. Pretty fucking functional. Clothing arranged in something approaching fastened order, I followed the sound of the voices to the galley. Everyone from the party was gathered there, with the notable exception of Schneider, and breakfast was in progress. I got a brief round of applause as I made my appearance. Crickshank grinned, bumped hips with me, and handed me a mug of coffee. By the look of her pupils, I wasn't the only one who'd been at the Mill-issue medicine pack. "What time did you guys wind up?" I asked, seating myself. Ole Hansen consulted his retinal display.
"About an hour ago. Luke here offered to cook. I went back to the camp for the stuff."
"What about Schneider?" Hansen shrugged and forked food into his mouth.
"Went with, but then he stayed. Why?"
"No reason."
"Here."
Luc Dupre slid an omelet-laden plate in front of me.
"Refuel."
I tried a couple of mouthfuls, but couldn't develop any enthusiasm for it. I wasn't feeling any definable pain, but there was a sickly instability underlying the numbness that I knew had set in at a cellular level. I hadn't had any real appetite for the last couple of days, and had been getting increasingly hard to hold food down early in the morning. I cut up the omelet and pushed the pieces around the plate, but in the end I left most of it. Dupre pretended not to notice, but you could tell he was hurt. "Anyone notice if our tiny friends are still burning?"
"There's smoke," said Hansen, "but not much of it. You're not going to eat that?"
I shook my head.
"Give it here."
He grabbed my plate and scraped it onto his own.
"You really must have overdone the local hooch last night."
"I'm dying, Ole," I said irritably.
"Yeah, maybe it's that. Or the pipe. My father told me never mix alcohol and whiff. Fucks you up."
A comset chime sounded from the other end of the table. Someone's discarded induction rig left on broadcast. Hansen grunted and reached for the set with his free hand. He held it to his ear.
"Hansen."
"Yeah."
He listened.
"All right, 5 minutes.
He listened again, and a thin smile appeared on his face.
"Right, I'll tell them. 10 minutes. Yeah."
He tossed the set back among the plates and grimaced.
"Sicciati?"
"Got it in one. Going to fly a recon over the nano colonies. Oh, yeah."
His grin came back.
"And the man says don't turn off your fucking rigs if you don't want to log a fucking disciplinary."
Dupre chuckled.
"Is that a fucking quote?"
"No, fucking paraphrase."
Hansen tossed his fork across his plate and stood up.
"He didn't say disciplinary. He called it a DP-9.
Running a platoon is a tricky job at the best of times. When your crew are all way past lethal spec ops prima donnas who've been killed at least once, it must be a nightmare. Sicciati wore it well. He watched without expression as we filed into the briefing room and found seats. The memory board on each seat had been set with a foil of edible painkillers, bent and stood on end. Someone whooped above the general murmur when they saw the drugs, then quieted down as Sicciati looked in their direction. When he spoke, his voice could have belonged to a restaurant mandroid recommending wine. "Anyone here who still has a hangover had better deal with it now. One of the outer ring sentry systems is down. There's no indication of how." It got the desired reaction. The murmur of conversation damped out. I felt my own endorphin high dip.
"Cruikshank and Hansen, I want you to take one of the bikes and go check it out. Any sign of activity, any activity at all, you beer off and get straight back here. Otherwise, I want you to recover any wreckage on site and bring it back for analysis. Vongsabath, I want the Nagini powered up and ready to lift at my command. Everybody else, arm yourselves and stay where you can be found. And wear your rigs at all times."
He turned to Tanya Wardani, who was slumped in a chair at the back of the room,
wrapped in her coat and masked with sun lenses. "Mr. Swardani, any chance of an estimated opening time?"
"Maybe tomorrow."
She gave no sign that she was even looking at him behind the lenses.
"With luck."
Someone snorted. Succiati didn't bother to track it.
"I don't need to remind you, Mr. Swardani, that we are under threat."
"No, you don't."
She unfolded herself from the chair and drifted for the exit.
"I'll be in the cave."
The meeting broke up in her wake. Hansen and Cruikshank were gone less than half an hour. "Nothing," the demolition specialist told Succiati when they got back. "No debris, no scorching, no signs of machine damage. In fact," he looked back over his shoulder, back to where they'd searched, "no sign the fucking thing was ever there in the first place." The tension in the camp notched higher. Most of the Spec Ops team, true to their individual callings, retreated into moody quiet and semi-obsessive examinations of the weapons they were skilled with. Hansen unpacked the corrosion grenades and studied their fuses. Cruikshank stripped down the mobile artillery systems. Succiati and Vongsavath disappeared into the cockpit of the Nagini, followed after a brief hesitation by Schneider. Luke Dupre sparred seriously with Jiang Zhanping down by the waterline, and Hand retreated into his bubble fab, presumably to burn some more incense. I spent the rest of the morning seated on a rock ledge above the beach with Sun Li Ping, hoping the residues from the night before would work their way out of my system before the painkillers did. The sky over us had the look of better weather. The previous day's nailed-down gray had broken apart on reefs of blue arrowing in from the west. Eastward, the smoke from Sauberville bent away with the evacuating cloud cover. Vague awareness of the hangover that waited beyond the curtain of endorphins lent the whole scene an undeservedly mellow tone. The smoke from the nano-colonies that Hansen had seen was gone altogether. When I mentioned the fact to Sun, she just shrugged. I wasn't the only one feeling irrationally mellow, it seemed. "Any of this worry you at all?" I asked her.
"This situation?"
She appeared to think about it.
"I've been in more danger, I think."
"Of course you have. You've been dead."
"Well, yes, but that wasn't what I meant. The nanosystems are a concern, but even if Matthias Hahn's fears are well-founded, I don't imagine they will evolve anything capable of pulling the Nagini out of the sky."
I thought about the grasshopper robot guns Hahn had mentioned. It was one of many details he had chosen not to pass on to the rest of the team when he briefed them on the Operin system.
"Does your family know what you do for a living?"
Sun looked surprised.
"Yes, of course. My father recommended the military. It was a good way of getting my systems training paid for. They always have money, he told me. Decide what you want to do, and then get them to pay you to do it. Of course, it never occurred to him that there'd be a war here. Who would have thought it 20 years ago?
"Yeah."
"And yours?"
"My what? My father? Don't know. Haven't seen him since I was 8. Nearly 40 years ago, subjective time. More than a century and a half, objective."
"I'm sorry."
"Don't be. My life got radically better when he left."
"Don't you think he'd be proud of you now?"
I laughed. "Oh, yeah, absolutely. He was always a big fan of violence, my old man. Season ticket holder to the freak fights. Of course, he had no formal training himself, so he always had to make do with defenseless women and children." I cleared my throat. "Anyway, yeah, he'd be proud of what I'd done with my life." Sun was quiet for a moment.
"And your mother?"
I looked away, trying to remember. The downside of Envoy Total Recall is that memories of everything before the conditioning tend to seem blurry and incomplete by comparison. You accelerate away from it all, like liftoff, like launch. It was an effect I'd craved at the time. Now I wasn't sure. I couldn't remember. "I think she was pleased when I enlisted," I said slowly. "When I came home in the uniform, she had a tea ceremony for me, invited everyone on the block. I guess she was proud of me. And the money must have helped. There were 3 of us to feed, me and 2 younger sisters. She did what she could after my father left, but we were always broke. When I finished basic, it must have tripled our income. On Harlan's world, the Protectorate pays its soldiers pretty well. It has to complete with the Yakuza and the Quellists."
"Does she know you are here?"
I shook my head. I was away too much. In the envoys, they deploy you everywhere except your home world. There's less danger of you developing some inconvenient empathy with the people you're supposed to be killing.
Yes, Sun nodded. A standard precaution. It makes sense. But you are no longer an envoy. Did you not return home?
I grinned mirthlessly. Yeah, as a career criminal. When you leave the envoys, there isn't much else on offer. And by that time, my mother was married to another man, a protectorate recruiting officer. Family reunion seemed, well, inappropriate. Sun said nothing for a while. She seemed to be watching the beach below us, waiting for something. Peaceful here, isn't it? I said, for something to say.
At a certain level of perception?
She nodded.
Not, of course, at a cellular level. There is a pitched battle being fought here, and we are losing.
That's right. Cheer me up. A smile flitted across her face.
Sorry, but it's hard to think in terms of peace when you have a murdered city on one hand, the pent-up force of a hyperportal on the other, a closing army of nano-creatures somewhere just over the hill, and the air awash with lethal-dose radiation.
Well, now that you put it like that... The smile came back.
It's my training, Kovach. I spend my time interacting with machines at levels my normal senses can't perceive. When you do that for a living, you start to see the storm beneath the calm everywhere. Look out there. You see a tideless ocean, sunlight falling on calm water. It's peaceful, yes. But under the surface of the water, there are millions of creatures engaged in a life-and-death struggle to feed themselves. Look, most of the gull corpses are gone already.
She grimaced.
Remind me not to go swimming. Even the sunlight is a solid fusillade of subatomic particles, blasting apart anything that hasn't evolved the appropriate levels of protection, which, of course, every living thing around here has, because its distant ancestors died in their millions so that a handful of survivors could develop the necessary mutational traits.
All peace is an illusion, huh? Sounds like something a renouncer monk would say.
Not an illusion, no, but it is relative. And all of it, all peace has been paid for somewhere, at some time, by its opposite.
That's what keeps you in the military, is it?
My contract is what keeps me in the military. I have another 10 years to serve, minimum. And if I'm honest, she shrugged, I'll probably stay on after that. The war will be over by then.
Always more wars.
Not on Sanction 4. Once they've crushed Kemp, there'll be a clampdown. Strictly police actions from then on. They'll never let it get out of hand like this again.
I thought about Han's exultation at the no-holds-barred licensing protocols Mandrake were currently running on, and I wondered. Aloud, I said, a police action can get you killed just as dead as a war.
I've been dead, and now look at me. It wasn't so bad.
All right, son. I felt a wave front of new wariness wash through me, turning my stomach and hurting my eyes. I give up. You're one tough motherfucker. You should be telling this stuff to Cruikshank. She'd eat it up.
I do not think Yvette Cruikshank needs any encouragement. She is young enough to be enjoying this for itself.
Yeah, you're probably right.
And if I appear a tough motherfucker to you, it was not my intention. But I am a career soldier, and it would be foolish to build resentment against that choice. It was a choice. I was not conscripted.
Yeah, well, these days that's... The edge ebbed out of my voice as I saw Schneider drop from the forward hatch of the Nagini and sprint up the beach. Where's he going? Below us, from under the angle of the ledge we were seated on, Tanya Wardani emerged. She was walking roughly seaward, but there was something odd about her gait. Her coat seemed to shimmer blue down one side in granular patches that looked vaguely familiar. I got to my feet, racked up the Nurichem. Sun laid a hand on my arm.
Is she?
It was sand. Patches of damp turquoise sand from the inside of the cavern. Sand that must have clung when... She crumpled. It was a graceless fall. Her left leg gave out as she put it down, and she pivoted around and downward around the buckling limb. I was already in motion, leaping down from the ledge in a series of Nurikem-mapped footholds, each one good only for momentary bracing and then on to the next before I could slip. I landed in the sand about the same time Wardani completed her fall, and was at her side a couple of seconds before Schneider.
"I saw her fall when she came out of the cave," he blurted as he reached me.
"Let's get her."
"I'm fine."
Wardani turned over and shook off my arm. She propped herself up on an elbow and looked from Schneider to me and back. I saw abruptly how haggard she had become.
"Both of you. I'm fine. Thanks."
"So what's going on?" I asked her quietly.
"What's going on?"
She coughed and spat in the sand, phlegm streaked with blood.
"I'm dying, just like everyone else in this neighborhood. That's what's going on." "Maybe you'd better not do any more work today," Schneider said hesitantly. "Maybe you should rest."
She shot him a quizzical look, then turned her attention to getting up.
"Oh, yeah."
She heaved herself upright and grinned.
"Forgot to say. I opened the gate. Cracked it."
I saw blood in the grin.
Chapter 27.
"I don't see anything," said Tsuchiyate.
Wardani sighed and walked to one of her consoles. She hit a sequence of screen panels, and one of the stretched filigrees eased down until it stood between us and the apparently impenetrable spike of Martian technology in the center of the cavern. Another screen switch and lamps seated in the corners of the cavern went incandescent with blue.
"There!"
Through the stretch screen, everything was bathed in cool violet light. In the new color scheme, the upper edges of the gate flickered and ran with gobs of brilliance that slashed through the surrounding glow like revolving biohazard cherries.
"What is that?"
asked Cruikshank at my back.
"It's a countdown," said Schneider, with dismissive familiarity. He'd seen this before. "Right, Tanya?"
Wardani smiled weakly and leaned on the console.
"We're pretty sure the Martians saw further into blue than we do. A lot of their visual notation seems to refer to bands in the ultraviolet range."
She cleared her throat.
"They'd be able to see this unaided. And what it's saying, more or less, is, stand clear."
I watched, fascinated. Each blob seemed to ignite at the peak of the spire, and then separate and drip rapidly along the leading edges to the base. At intervals along the drip-down, the lights fired bursts off themselves into the folding that filled the splits between the edges. It was hard to tell, but if you track the trajectory of these off-bursts, they seemed to be traveling a long way into the cramped geometry of each crack, a longer distance than they had any right to in three-dimensional space.
"Some of it becomes visual later,"
said Wardani.
"The frequency scales down as we get nearer to the event. Not sure why."
Tsuchiyate turned aside. In the splashes of rendered light through the filigree screen, he looked unhappy.
"How long?"
he asked. Wardani lifted an arm and pointed along the console to the scrambling digits of a countdown display.
"About 6 hours, standard. A little less now." "Samadhi's sake, that is beautiful,"
breathed Cruikshank. She stood at my shoulder and stared entranced at the screen spike and what was happening to it. The light passing over her face seemed to have washed her features of every emotion but wonder.
"We'd better get that buoy up here, Captain."
Hand was peering into the explosions of radiance with an expression I hadn't seen since I surprised him at worship.
"And the launching frame. We'll need to fire it across."
Tsuchiyate turned his back on the gate.
"Cruikshank! Cruikshank!"
"Sir?"
The Lyman woman blinked and looked at him, but her eyes kept tugging back toward the screen.
"Get back down to the Nagini and help Hansen prep the buoy for firing. And tell Vongsavath to get a launch and landing mapped for tonight. See if she can't break through some of this jamming and transmit to the wedge at Maison. Tell them we're coming out."
He looked across at me.
"I'd hate to get shot down by friendly fire at this stage."
I glanced at Hand, curious to see how he'd handle this one.
"I needn't have worried."
"No transmissions just yet, Captain."
The executive's voice was a study in absent detachment. You would have sworn he was absorbed in the gate countdown. But under the casual tone, there was the unmistakable tensile strength of an order given.
Let's keep this on a need-to-know basis until we're actually ready to go home. Just get Bongsavath to map the parabola. Suchiati wasn't stupid. He heard the cabling buried in Han's voice and shot me another look, questioning. I shrugged and weighed in on the side of Han's deception. What are envoys for, after all?
Look at it this way, Suchiati. If they knew you were on board, they'd probably shoot us down anyway, just to get to you.
Carrera's wedge, Han said stiffly, will do no such thing while they are under contract to the cartel. Don't you mean the government? Jeered Schneider. I thought this war was an internal matter, Han.
Han shot him a weary look. Vongsavath.
Suchiati had chinned his mic to the general channel.
You there?
In place.
And the rest of you? Four more voices thrummed in the induction mic at my ear. Hansen and Zhang taut with alertness, Dupre laconic, and Sun somewhere in between.
Mappa launch and landing. Here to landfall. We expect to be out of here in another 7 hours.
A round of cheers rang through the induction mic at my ear.
Try to get some idea of what the suborbital traffic's like along the curve, but maintain transmission silence until we lift. Is that clear?
Silent running,
said Bongsavath.
Got it.
Good.
Suchiati nodded at Cruikshank, and the Lyman woman loped out of the cavern.
Henson, Cruikshank's coming down to help prep the claim buoy, that's all. The rest of you, stay sharp.
Suchiati unlocked his posture slightly and turned to face the archaeologue.
Mistress Wardani, you look ill. Is there anything remaining for you to do here?
I...
Wardani sagged visibly over the console.
No. I'm done. Until you want the damn thing closed again.
Oh, that won't be necessary. Han called out from where he stood to one side of the gate, looking up at it with a distinctly proprietorial air.
With the buoy established, we can notify the cartel and bring in a full team. With wedge support, I imagine we can render this a ceasefire zone, he smiled, rather rapidly.
Try telling that to Kemp, said Schneider.
Oh, we will, Han smiled smoothly.
In any case, Mr. Swadani,
Suchiati's tone was impatient. I suggest you return to the Nagini as well. Ask Cruikshank to jack her field medic program and look you over.
Well, thanks.
I beg your pardon.
Wardani shook her head and propped herself upright.
I thought one of us should say it.
She left without a backward glance. Schneider looked at me, and after a moment's hesitation went after her.
You got away with civilians, Suchiati. Anyone ever tell you that?
He stared at me impassively.
Is there some reason for you to stay?
I like the view.
He made a noise in his throat and looked back at the gate. You could tell he didn't like doing it, and with Cruikshank gone, he was letting the feeling leak out. There was a gathered stiffness about his stance as soon as he faced the device, something akin to the tension you see in bad fighters before a bout. I put up a flat hand in clear view, and after a proper pause, I slapped him lightly on the shoulder.
Don't tell me this thing scares you, Suchiati. Not the man who faced down Dog Voiton and his whole squad. You were my hero for a while back there.
If he thought it was funny, he kept it to himself.
Come on, it's a machine. Like a crane, like a...
I groped about for appropriate comparisons.
Like a machine. That's all it is. We'll be building these ourselves in a few centuries. Take out the right sleeve insurance, you might even live to see it.
You're wrong, he said distantly. This isn't like anything human.
Ah, shit, you're not going to get mystical on me, are you?
I glanced across to where Han stood, suddenly feeling unfairly ganged up on.
Of course it isn't like anything human. Humans didn't build it, the Martians did. But they're just another race. Smarter than us maybe, farther ahead than us maybe, but that doesn't make them gods or demons, does it? Does it?
He turned to face me.
I don't know. Does it?
Suchiati, I swear you're beginning to sound like that moron over there. This is technology you're looking at.
No, he shook his head. This is a threshold we're about to step over. And we're going to regret it.
Can't you feel that? Can't you feel the waiting in it?
No, but I can feel the waiting in me. If this thing creeps you out so much, can we go and do something constructive?
That would be good.
Han seemed content to stay and gloat over his new toy. So we left him there and made our way back along the tunnel. Suchiati's jitters must have sparked across to me somehow, though, because as the first twist took us out of sight of the activated gate, I had to admit that I felt something on the back of my neck. It was the same feeling you sometimes get when you turn your back on weapon systems you know are armed. No matter that you're tagged safe, you know that the thing at your back has the power to turn you into small shreds of flesh and bone, and that despite all the programming in the world, accidents happen. And friendly fire kills you just as dead as the unfriendly kind. At the entrance, the bright, diffused glare of daylight waited for us like some inversion of the dark, compressed thing within. I shook the thought loose irritably. "You happy now?" I inquired acidly as we stepped out into the light. "I'll be happy when we've deployed the buoy and put a hemisphere between us and that thing." I shook my head. "I don't get you, Suchiati. Landfall's built within sniper fire of 6 major digs. This whole planet is riddled with Martian ruins."
"I'm from Latimer originally. I go where they tell me."
"All right, Latimer. They're not short on ruins either. Jesus, every fucking world we've colonized belonged to them once. We've got their charts to thank for being out here in the first place."
"Exactly."
Suchiati stopped dead and swung on me with the closest thing I'd seen to true emotion on his face since he'd lost the tussle over blasting the rockfall away from the gate.
"Exactly. And you want to know what that means?"
I leaned back, surprised by the sudden intensity.
"Yeah, sure, tell me." "It means we shouldn't be out here, Kovach."
He was speaking in a low, urgent voice I hadn't heard him use before.
"We don't belong here. We're not ready. It's a stupid fucking mistake that we stumbled onto the astrogation charts in the first place. Under our own steam, it would have taken us thousands of years to find these planets and colonize them. We needed that time, Kovach. We needed to earn our place in interstellar space. Instead, we got out here bootstrapping ourselves on a dead civilization we don't understand."
"I don't think..." He trampled the objection down.
"Look how long it's taken the archaeologue to open that gate. Look at all the half-understood scraps we've depended on to come this far. We're pretty sure the Martians saw further into blue than we do."
He mimicked Wardani savagely.
"She's got no idea, and neither does anyone else. We're guessing. We have no idea what we're doing, Kovach. We wander around out here, nailing our little anthropomorphic certainties to the cosmos, and whistling in the dark, but the truth is, we haven't the faintest fucking idea what we're doing. We shouldn't be out here at all. We do not belong here."
I pushed out a long breath. "Well, Suchiati..." I looked at ground and sky in turn. "You'd better start saving for a needle cast to Earth. Place is a shithole, of course, but it's where we're from. We sure as hell belong there." He smiled a little, rear guard cover for the emotion now receding from his face as the mask of command slid back on.
"It's too late for that," he said quietly.
"Much too late for that." Down by the Nagini, Hansen and Cruikshank were already stripping down the Mandrake claim buoy. Chapter 28. It took Cruikshank and Hansen the best part of an hour to prep the Mandrake claim buoy, mostly because Han came down out of the cave and insisted on running 3 full systems checks before he was satisfied with the device's ability to do the job.
"Look,"
Hansen said irritably as they powered up the locational computer for the third time.
"It snaps onto starfield occlusion, and once it's patterned the trace, there's nothing short of a dark body event going to tear it loose. Unless this starship of yours habitually makes itself invisible, there's no problem."
"That isn't impossible," Han told him. "Run the mass detector back up again. Make sure it fires up on deployment." Hansen sighed. At the other end of the 2-meter buoy, Cruikshank grinned. Later, I helped her carry the launch cradle down from the Nagini's hold and bolt the thing together on its garish yellow tracks. Hansen finished the last of the systems checks, slapped panels shut along the conical body, and patted the machine affectionately on one flank.
"All ready for the big deep," he said.
With the launch cradle assembled and working, we enlisted Zhang Zhanping's help and lifted the buoy gently into place. Originally designed to be deployed through a torpedo tube, it looked vaguely ridiculous, crouched on the tiny, tracked cradle, as if it might tip over on its nose at any moment. Hansen ran the tracks back and forth, then around in a couple of circles to check mobility, then snapped the remote off, pocketed it, and yawned.
"Anyone want to see if we can catch a Lapin A spot?" he asked.
I checked my retinal time display, where I'd synchronized a stopwatch function to the countdown in the cave. A little over 4 hours to go. Behind the flaring green numerals in the corner of my vision, I saw the buoy's nose twitch and then pivot forward over the rolled front of the cradle tracks. It bedded in the sand with a solid little thump. I glanced over at Hansen and grinned.
"Oh, for Samadhi's sake," said Crickshank when she saw where we were looking.
She stalked over to the cradle.
"Well, don't just stand there grinning like a bunch of idiots. Help me."
She ripped apart. I was closest, already turning to answer her call for help. Later, recalling in the sick numbness of the aftermath, I saw, remembered, how the impact split her from just above the hip bone, sawed upward in a careless back-and-forth scribble, and tossed the pieces skyward in a fountain of blood. It was spectacular, like some kind of total-body gymnast's trick gone wrong. I saw one arm and a fragment of torso hurled up over my head. A leg spun past me, and the trailing edge of the foot caught me a glancing blow across the mouth. I tasted blood. Her head climbed lazily into the sky, rotating, whipping the long hair and a ragged tail of neck and shoulder flesh end over end like party streamers. I felt the patter of more blood, hers this time, falling like rain on my face. I heard myself scream as if from a very long distance, half the word "no" torn loose of its meaning. Beside me, Hansen dived after his discarded sunjet. I could see.
Yells from the Najini.
The thing.
Someone cut loose with a blaster.
That did it. Around the launch cradle, the sand seethed with activity. The thick barbed cable that had ripped Crickshank open was one of a half a dozen, pale gray and shimmering in the light. They seemed to exude a droning sound that itched in my ears. They laid hold of the cradle and tore at it. Metal creaked. A bolt tore free of its mountings and whirred past me like a bullet. The blaster discharged again, joined by others in a ragged chorus of crackling. I saw the beams lance through the thing in the sand and leave it unchanged. Hansen walked past me, sunjet cradled to his shoulder, still firing. Something clicked into place.
"Get back!"
I screamed at him.
"Get the fuck back!"
The Kalashnikovs filled my fists. Too late. Hansen must have thought he was up against armoring, or maybe just rapidity of evasive motion. He'd spread his beam to beat the ladder, and was about to up the power. The General Systems Sunjet Snipe Mark 11 will cut through tantalum steel like a knife through flesh. At close range, it vaporizes. The cables might have glowed a little in places. Then the sand under his feet erupted, and a fresh tentacle whiplashed upward. It shredded his legs to the knee in the time it took me to lower the smart guns halfway to the horizontal. He screamed shrilly, an animal sound, and toppled, still firing. The sunjet turned sand to glass in long, shallow gouges around him. Short, thick cables rose and fell like flails over his trunk. His screaming jerked to a halt. Blood gouted lumpily, like the froth of lava you see in the caldera of a volcano. I walked in, firing. The guns, the interface guns, like rage extended in both hands. Biofeed from the palm plates gave me detail. High-impact fragmentation load, magazines full to capacity. The vision I had outside my fury found structure in the writhing thing before me, and the Kalashnikovs punched solid fire at it. The biofeed put my aim in place with micrometer precision. Lengths of cable chopped and jumped, dropping to the sand and flopping there like landed fish. I emptied both guns. They spat out their magazines and gaped open eagerly. I pounded the butts against my chest. The harness loader delivered. The gun butts sucked the fresh clips in with slick magnetic clicks. Heavy again, my hands whipped out, left and right, seeking, sighting. The killing cables were gone, chopped off. The others surged at me through the sand and died, cut to pieces like vegetables under a chef's knife. I emptied again. Reloaded. Emptied. Reloaded. Emptied. Reloaded. Emptied. Reloaded. Emptied. and beat my chest repeatedly, not hearing as the harness clicked empty at me. The cables around me were down to a fringe of feebly waving stumps. I threw away the emptied guns and seized a random length of steel from the wrecked launch cradle. Up over my head and down, the nearest crop of stumps shivered apart. Up, down. Fragments, splinters. Up, down. I raised the bar and saw Crookshank's head looking up at me. It had fallen face up on the sand, long, tangled hair half obscuring the wide-open eyes. Her mouth was open, as if she were going to say something, and there was a pained expression frozen across her features. The buzzing in my ears had stopped. I dropped my arms. The bar. My gaze to the feebly twitching lengths of cable around me. In the sudden, cold, flooding return of sanity, Jiang was at my side.
"Get me a corrosion grenade," I said, and my voice was unrecognizable in my own ears.
The Nagini hovered 3 meters above the beach. Solid-load machine guns were mounted at the open loading hatches on both sides. Dupre and Jiang crouched behind each weapon, faces painted pale by the backglow from the tiny screens of the remote sensing sites. There had been no time thus far to arm the automated systems. The hold behind them was piled with hastily recovered items from the bubble fabs. Weaponry, food canisters, clothing, whatever could be swept up and carried at the run under the watchful gaze of the machine gun cover. The Mandrake claim buoy lay at one end of the hold, curved body shifting slightly back and forth on the metal deck, as Amelie Vongsavath made tiny adjustments to the Nagini's holding buoyancy. At Matthias Hand's insistence, it had been the first item recovered from the suddenly perilous flat expanse of turquoise sand below us. The others obeyed him numbly. The buoy was very likely wrecked. The conical casing was scarred and torn open along its length. Monitor panels had been ripped off their hinges, and the innards extruded like the shredded ends of entrails, like the remains of...
Stop that. 2 hours remaining. The numerals flared in my eye. Yvette Cruikshank and Ole Hansen were aboard.
The human remains retrieval system, itself a grav-lift robot, had floated delicately back and forth above the gore-splattered sand, vacuumed up what it could find, tasted and tested for DNA, and then regurgitated separately into 2 of the half a dozen tasteful blue body bags sprouting from the tubes at its rear. The separation and deposit process made sounds that reminded me of vomiting. When the retrieval robot was done, each bag was snapped free, laser-sealed at the neck, and barcoded. Stone-faced, Suciati carried them one at a time to the corpse locker at the back of the hold and stowed them. Neither bag seemed to contain anything even remotely human-shaped. Neither of the cortical stacks had been recovered. Amelie Vongsavath was scanning for traces, but the current theory was that the nanobes cannibalized anything non-organic to build the next generation. No one could find Hansen and Cruikshank's weapons, either. I stopped staring a hole in the corpse locker hatch and went upstairs. On the crew deck, in the aft cabin, a sample length of nanobe cable lay sealed in permaplastic, under the eye of Sun Li Ping's microscope. Suciati and Han crowded behind her. Tanya Wardani leaned in a corner, arms hugged around herself, face locked. I sat down, well away from all of them.
"Take a look."
Sun glanced around me and cleared her throat.
"It's what you said."
"Then I don't need to look."
"You're saying these are the nanobes?" asked Suciati, incredulous.
"Not." "The gate isn't even fucking open, Suciati."
I could hear the fraying in my own voice. Sun peered again into the microscope screen. She seemed to have found an obscure form of refuge there.
"It's an interlocking configuration," she said, "but the components don't actually touch. They must be related to each other purely through field dynamics. It's like a very strong electromagnetic muscle system over a mosaic skeleton. Each nanobe generates a portion of the field, and that's what webs it in place. The sunjet blast just passes through it. It might vaporize a few individual nanobes in the direct path of the beam, although they do seem to be resistant to very high temperatures. But anyway, that's not enough to damage the overall structure, and, sooner or later, other units shift in to replace the dead cells. The whole thing's organic.
Hand looked down at me curiously.
You knew this.
I looked at my hands. They were still trembling slightly. Beneath the skin of my palms, the bioplates flexed restlessly. I made an effort to hold it down. I worked it out in the firefight. I stared back up at him, peripherally noticed that Wardani was looking at me too. Call it envoy intuition. The sunjets don't work because we've already subjected the colonies to high-temperature plasma fire. They've evolved to beat it, and now they've got conferred immunity to beam weapons.
And the ultra-vibe?
Suchiati was talking to Sun. She shook her head.
I've passed a test blast across it, and nothing happens. The nanobes resonate inside the field, but it doesn't damage them. Less effect than the sunjet beam.
Solid ammunition's the only thing that works, Han said thoughtfully. Yeah, and not for much longer. I got up to leave. Give them some time, they'll evolve past that, too. That and the corrosion grenades. I should have saved them for later.
Where are you going, Kovach?
If I were you, Hand, I'd get Amelie to lift us a little higher. Once they learn not everything that kills them lives on the ground, they're likely to start growing longer arms. I walked out, trailing the advice like clothing discarded on the way to bed and long sleep. I found my way more or less at random back down to the hold, where it seemed the automated targeting systems on the machine guns had been enabled. Luke Dupre stood on the opposite side of the hatch from his weapon, smoking one of Cruikshank's Indigo City cigars, and staring down at the beach 3 meters below. At the far end of the deck, Zhan Junping was seated cross-legged in front of the corpse locker. The air was stiff with the uncomprehending silence that serves males as a function of grief. I slumped against a bulkhead and squeezed my eyes closed. The countdown flared in the sudden darkness behind my eyelids. 1 hour, 53 minutes. Counting down. Cruikshank flickered through my head, grinning, focused on a task, smoking, in the throes of orgasm, shredded into the sky.
Stop that.
I heard the brush of clothing near me and looked up. Zhang was standing in front of me.
Kovach.
He crouched to my level and started again.
Kovach, I am sorry. She was a fine soul.
The interface gun flashed out of my right hand, and the barrel punched him in the forehead. He sat down backward with a shock.
Shut up, Zhang.
I clamped my mouth shut and drew a breath.
You say one more fucking word, and I'll paint Luke with your brains.
I waited, the gun at the end of my arm feeling as if it weighed 12 kilos. The bioplate hung onto it for me. Eventually, Zhang got to his feet and left me alone. 1 hour 50. It pulsed in my head. Chapter 29. Han called the meeting formally at 1 hour and 17 minutes, cutting it fine, but then maybe he was letting everybody air their feelings informally first. There'd been shouting from the upper deck pretty much since I left. Down in the hold, I could hear the tone of it, but not without applying the Neurochem, the substance. It seemed to have been going on for a long time. From time to time I heard people come and go in the hold, but none of them came near me, and I couldn't muster the energy or the interest to look up. The only person not giving me a wide berth, it seemed, was Cemetery.
Did I not tell you there was work for me here?
I closed my eyes.
Where is my anti-personnel round, Wedgewolf? Where is your flamboyant fury now when you need it?
I don't...
Are you looking for me now?
I don't do that shit no more. Laughter, like the gravel of cortical stacks pouring from a scoop.
Kovach?
I looked up. It was Luke Dupre.
I think you'd better come upstairs,
he said. Over our heads, the noise seemed to have quieted down.
We are not, Han said quietly, looking around the cabin. I repeat... Not leaving here without staking a mandrake claim on the other side of that gate. Read the terms of your contracts.
The phrasing, every available avenue of opportunity, is paramount and omnipresent.
Whatever Captain Succiati orders you to do now, you will be executed and returned to the soul dumps if we leave without exploring those avenues. Am I making myself clear?
No, you're not,
shouted Amelie Vongsabath through the connecting hatch from the cockpit. Because the only avenue I can see is carrying a fucked mocker buoy up the beach by hand and trying to throw it bodily through the gate on the off chance it might still work. That doesn't sound to me like an opportunity for anything except suicide. These things take your stack.
We can scan for the nanobes, but angry voices trampled hand down. He raised his hands over his head in exasperation. Succiati snapped for quiet and got it.
We are soldiers.
Zhang spoke unexpectedly into the sudden lull.
Not Kempist conscripts. This is not a fighting chance.
He looked around, seeming to have surprised himself as much as anyone else.
When you sacrificed yourself on the denying plane, Han said, you knew you had no fighting chance. You gave up your life. That's what I'm buying from you now.
Zhang looked at him with open disdain.
I gave my life for the soldiers under my command, not for commerce.
Oh, Dumbala!
Han tipped his eyes to the ceiling.
What do you think this war is about, you stupid fucking grunt? Who do you think paid for the Da Nang assault? Get it through your head. You are fighting for me, for the corporates and their puppet fucking government.
Han. I stepped off the hatch ladder and into the center of the cabin. I think your sales technique's flagging. Why don't you give it a rest?
Kovach, I am not...
Sit down. The words tasted like ashes across my tongue, but there must have been something more substantial in them, because he did it. Faces turned expectantly in my direction. Not this again. We're not going anywhere, I said. We can't. I want out of here as much as any of you, but we can't. Not until we've placed the buoy. I waited out the surf of objections, profoundly disinterested in quelling them. Succiati did it for me. The quiet that followed was thin. I turned to Hand. Why don't you tell them who deployed the Operin system? Tell them why. He just looked at me. All right, I'll tell them. I looked around at all the watching faces, feeling the quiet harden and thicken as they listened. I gestured at Hand. Our sponsor here has a few homegrown enemies back in Landfall, who'd quite like him not to come back. The nanobes are their way of trying to ensure he doesn't. So far, that hasn't worked. But back in Landfall, they don't know that. If we lift out of here, they will know, and I doubt we'll make the first half of the launch curve before something pointed comes looking for us. Right, Matthias? Hand nodded.
And the wedge code? Asked Succiati. That counts for nothing?
More gabbled queries boiled over in the wake of his question.
What wedge code? Is that an incoming ID? Thanks for the... How come we didn't...
Shut up, all of you!
To my amazement, they did. Wedge Command transmitted an incoming code for our use in an emergency. You weren't made aware of it because... I felt a smile form on my mouth like a scab. You didn't need to know. You didn't matter enough. Well, now you know, and I guess it might seem like a guarantee of safe passage. Han, you want to explain the fallacy there? He looked at the ground for a moment, then back up. There seemed to be something firming in his eyes.
Wedge Command are answerable to the cartel, he said with a measure of a lecturer. Whoever deployed the Operin system nanobes would have needed some form of cartel sanction. The same channels would provide them with the authorization codes Isaac Carrera operates under. The Wedge are the most likely candidates to shoot us down.
Luke Dupre shifted lazily against a bulkhead.
Your Wedge, Kovach. I don't believe they will murder one of their own. They're not known for it.
I tipped a glance at Succiati. His face tightened. Unfortunately, I said, Succiati here is wanted for the murder of a Wedge officer. My association with him makes me a traitor. All Han's enemies have to do is provide Carrera with a crew list for the expedition. It'll short-circuit any influence I have.
You could not bluff. I understood the envoys were famous for that.
I nodded. I might try that, but the odds aren't good, and there is an easier way. That cut across the low babble of dispute.
Dupre inclined his head.
And that is?
The only thing that gets us out of here in one piece is deployment of the buoy, or something like it. With a Mandrake flag on the starship, all bets are off and we're home free. Anything less can be read as a bluff, or even if they believe what we found, Han's pals can swoop in here and deploy their own buoy after we're dead. We have to transmit a claim confirmation to beat that option. It was a moment that held so much tension. The air seemed to wobble, rocking like a chair pushed onto its back legs. They were all looking at me. They were all fucking looking at me.
Please, not this again.
The gate opens in an hour. We blast the surrounding rock off with the ultravibe, we fly through the gate, and we deploy the fucking buoy. Then we go home. The tension erupted again. I stood in the chaos of voices and waited, already knowing how the surf would batter itself out. They'd come around. They'd come around because they'd see what Hand and I already knew. They'd see it was the only loophole, the only way back for us all. And anyone who didn't see it that way... I felt a tremor of wolf splice go through me, like a snarl. Anyone who didn't see it that way, I'd shoot. For someone whose specialty was machine systems and electronic disruption, Sun turned out to be remarkably proficient with heavy artillery. She test-fired the ultravibe battery at a handful of targets up and down the cliffs, and then had Amelie Vongsavath float the Nagini up to less than 50 meters off the cave entrance. With the forward re-entry screens powered up to fend off the debris, she opened fire on the rockfall. It made the sound of wire ends scratched across soft plastic, the sound of autumn fire beetles feeding on bellowweed at low tide, the sound of Tanya Wardani removing the spinal bone from Deng Xiaojun's cortical stack in the Landfall Fuck Hotel. It was all of these chirruping, chittering, screeching sounds, mixed and amped to doomsday proportions. It was a sound like the world splintering apart. I watched it on a screen down in the hold, with the two automated machine guns and the corpse locker for company. There wasn't space for an audience in the cockpit anyway, and I didn't feel like staying in the crew cabin with the rest of the living. I sat on the deck and stared disconnected at the images, rock changing color with shocking vividness as it crazed and shattered under pressure of plate tectonic magnitude, then the rushing collapse of the shards as they hurried downward, turned to dense clouds of powder before they could escape the ultravibe beams, probing back and forth in the debris. I could feel a vague discomfort in the pit of my stomach from the backwash. Sun was firing on low intensity, and shielding in the weapons pod kept the worst of the ultravibe blast damped down aboard the Nagini. But still the shrill scream of the beam and the pitted screeches of the tortured rock clawed their way in through the two open hatches and screwed into my ears like surgery. I kept seeing Cruikshank die. 23 minutes. The ultravibe shut down. The gate emerged from the devastation and billowing dust like a tree through a blizzard. Wardani had told me it wouldn't be harmed by any weapon she knew of, but Sun had still programmed the Nagini's weapon systems to cease fire as soon as they had visual. Now, as the dust clouds began to drift away, I saw the tangled remnants of the archaeologue's equipment, torn and flung apart by the final seconds of the ultravibe blast. It was hard to believe the dense integrity of the artifact bulking above the debris. A tiny feather of awe brushed down my spine. A sudden recollection of what I was looking at. Sujiati's words came back to me. We do not belong here. We are not ready. I shrugged it off.
Kovach?
From the sound of Amelie Vongsavath's voice over the induction rig, I wasn't the only one with the elder civilization jitters.
Here. I'm closing the deck hatches. Stand clear.
The machine gun mounts slid smoothly backward into the body of the deck, and the hatches lowered, shutting out the light. A moment later, the interior lighting flickered on, cold.
Some movement,
Sun said warningly. She was on the general channel, and I heard the succession of sharp, indrawn breaths from the rest of the crew. There was a slight jolt as Vongsavath shifted the Nagini up a few more meters. I steadied myself against the bulkhead and, despite myself, looked down the deck under my feet.
No, it's not under us.
It was as if Sun had been watching me.
I think it's going for the gate.
Fuck, Hand! How much of this thing is there?
Dupre asked. I could almost see